Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts every week from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another episode of the Lending Forward podcast. My name is Sarah Rogers. I'm going to be your host today. We're really excited for this episode. It's kind of a follow-up to an event that we, Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, had in early January. So our guest today is none other than Logan Motoshami, Housing Wire's lead analyst. We were lucky enough for him to come on and do a economic forecast in early January, and we had a ton of buzz from it. Some Q&A came in, and we wanted to get to all of those burning questions. So Logan, thank you so much for coming on today to kind of wrap things up.
It is wonderful to be here. I always love questions. It's the best part of my job.
I love it. And I'm not alone today hosting. I do have an awesome co-host, Mr. Bill Hitchcock, with me as well. Bill, if you want to say hello to everyone.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me back. Logan, good seeing you again. It seems like we were just chatting just a few days ago, so excited to get back into it.
Awesome. Well, thank you both. Bill, if you want to dive in and start peppering Logan with questions.
Yeah.
And get us started.
Yeah, you know I'm not shy. So this is one of the things that really stuck with me, Logan. It's funny because I was out at an event, at a charitable event with some friends, and one of them was talking about how he was getting ready to have, I think it's like his fifth kid, and they were talking about whether to renovate their house because they didn't want to go and buy another house because they were saying, okay, well, that I can sell mine, but the next house that I'm going to buy is going to be even more. And luckily, we just finished up the econ forecast with you, and I was trying to eloquently reiterate what you had said about just when you're looking at the 30-year fixed loan, how you were talking about and showing the charts around. It's such a phenomenal program and product that we have, and that payment is fixed for that period of time. And it was just like the lights went off, you know, in his head, just kind of thinking about that the next home he buys is still going to appreciate at that higher level. So can you touch on that again for kind of, you know, our guests to really make that correlation, why that product makes lending and buying, you know, really buying a home such a great value option and such a great investment tool?
So I always looked at housing as the cost of shelter to your own capacity to own a debt, but once you buy that home, the 30-year fixed payment portion of it, excluding the taxes and insurance, is set in stone. And the benefit of housing in America that other countries don't have is that once that's in, your wages rise every single year, right? In an inflationary period, why some people always say housing is the best hedge against inflation is that traditionally if you're a W-2 employer, you get your wages grow faster during an inflationary period, but your house cost stays the same, where for a renter, it isn't the case. So always we have this benefit that when you buy that next house, depending on how your work life is, your wages grow every single year, that payment stays the same. That shelter cost in itself will become less burdensome for you going out in the future. But also after 2010, the qualified mortgage rules pretty much set in stone that everyone who's going to buy a primary resident house is legit anyway. So what we've had in the last, 15 years is that people bought their homes, they stayed in them for a very long time. Their cash flows are excellent. So they can handle any kind of economic shock to that degree. And this is one of the reasons why forbearance itself came lower. So whenever you buy a house, you always look at it in the long-term view that, okay, this is my fixed payment every single year, how long I'm going to work for, wages are going to rise, and that makes the cost of shelter less for you based on your wages. We never talk about housing in that way because it gets a little bit more complicated, but in this slide, it really showed itself why people like staying in their homes for a very long time and why the 30-year fixed product is the envy of the world. Like other countries don't have our kind of plumbing, our Freddie, Fannie, VA, FHA. A lot of countries are tied to short-term rates, so their mortgage payment can jump on them, and they have to constantly refinance every 2, 3, 5 years, or even 10 years. fixed payment, wages rise. And another thing is that, you know, excluding your friend, of course, family sizes have been getting smaller and smaller while we've been building bigger and bigger homes. So a lot of the products that we build now, especially over the last three decades, would actually be very suitable for a family of four. And in this context, you could see why homeowners on paper have never looked better.
So Logan, I think that that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure you hear the conversation all the time, and people are probably always asking you, you know, friends and professional colleagues as well, of, yeah, should I buy now? Should I wait? You know, all those different things. So when they ask you in that simplest form, you know, what are you telling everybody?
Okay, this is really funny because this is a topic very near and dear to me. If somebody comes to me and asks me if they should buy a house, my answer is always the same, no. And there's a reason for this. After 2010, everyone has to be pre-qualified. So every person has to go to their mortgage professional and get pre-qualified to know how much they could actually afford. That answers a lot of their question. But when somebody comes to me and says, should I buy a house, without saying their name, what their income is, what their situation is, my feeling, and this is the old high school basketball coach of me, you're not ready. Because millions of people are buying homes every single year. They bought in 2008, they bought during COVID, they bought near 5 million homes because they're ready. So the best advice I could give to everybody, go to your mortgage professional, get pre-qualified. Just like myself, when I was an LO, I would always ask somebody, what's your comfort mortgage payment level? Before we went into the qualifications, and they would have an idea, because each person has their own individual financial situation, their jobs, their incomes, their financial asset. You cannot allow anyone to actually dictate that to you. You get pre-qualified, that answer will be to you. So this is why I'm always adamant in saying, if you're coming to me and I don't know anything about your finances, there's something about you saying you're not ready to buy, because that person bought last year, this person's about to buy next week, that person bought in 2020. You know when you're ready, when you're financially ready, because why? It is a 30-year fixed payment. It's not that difficult. This is the cost of shelter, what you're going to get every single year. This is your job, your wages, your income, your financial asset, the schools, your neighbors, where you're going to work. There's all these other variables that go into housing that only the person can answer themselves. But for me, boy, you just go to that mortgage person, get pre-qualified, know that payment level, and go with it.
Yeah, that's great. I think that, you know, a reason why a lot of people are always asking, oh, should I do it now? Should I wait? Is because of rates, you know, the big bad word, rates. And it's interesting to me, and this is one of the questions that came in. Someone said, why does the Fed control interest rates rather than something like supply and demand? So why do we have to rely on the Fed for things?
So the Federal Reserve is basically, in a sense, the lender of last resort for the U.S. economy, and they control, you know, short-term rates. They can buy bonds, sell bonds. Without the Federal Reserve, our economy gets into kind of whiplashes of inflationary and deflationary periods. So their job is to control the economic cycle as much as they can. And we've had much longer economic expansions and much shorter recessions with the Federal Reserve in place. So it is very critical for the U.S. economy to always have the Federal Reserve. But they only really control the short-term rates. So back in the previous decade, we had zero interest rate policies for a very long time. We couldn't get inflation to even break over 2% on a year-over-year basis. The recovery was very slow and weak. So their job is just to manage that. But whenever there's a crisis, like last year, we had a banking crisis. Silicon Valley Bank overnight went under. If the Fed didn't come in and do emergency lending provisions, those banks would have a cascade of going under and their loans going bad, and then it would have gone and on and on. So their job is to basically, in a sense, be the lender of last resort and manage the money. So they are very critical in that. Sometimes, because the institution is slow, they are slow to react to economic cycle work, right? That's always been the criticism of the Fed. They're slow. So they're going to be slow on this side. They should be cutting rates already, right? The growth rate of inflation has fallen down because it looks like a disinflation global pandemic, not the 1970s. but they are very critical in making sure that inflation doesn't get out of hand in the employment situation. We want to get as full employment as we possibly can without having wages spiral out of control. And for the most part, they have done that. There are times where the credit markets, that's not in their control, like the housing bubble boom. That wasn't because of low mortgage rates. That's because the credit markets facilitated a lot of credit growth. So they are just managing the economy, not really controlling things so much. But they do control the short-term rates, the borrowing costs. And a lot of times the Fed's job to cool the economy, they raise the cost of, for example, construction loans have gone up so much so fast that the apartment boom is already over here in America. That they believe that's the best way to deal with inflation. So think of them as kind of a steward of an economy. There's other factors, bond markets, the appetite for investors in our bond markets really control the long end of the bond market mortgage rates. So they're not the biggest controller of that.
So one of the things that I think came up too, and I remember it being in the chat, but I can't quite remember which mortgage banker or which one of our mortgage bankers asked it, but they were asking, so you had mentioned that the Fed needs to care about housing. They seem that they're battling a number of factors, and housing is not high on their list. So have they historically cared more about housing like prior to now, or do you feel that they're what's the priority that we're looking for?
I would say this. We are in the third calendar year of the great financial recession lows in housing demand, right? Back in 2008, we were hovering a little bit under 4 million. This is the third year that we're starting. Back then, the Fed was cutting rates. They were buying mortgage-backed securities. They were doing whatever they can to help housing demand get better. When COVID happened, right, they went straight into buying mortgage-backed securities. They lowered interest rate because they wanted the housing market to stay firm. Here, nothing. In fact, last year in February, when mortgage rates got to 6% and housing demand was picking up, one of the Fed presidents came out and said, no, wait a second. Housing demand's coming up. It's going to make our jobs harder. Oh, boo-hoo. It has nothing to do even with rent inflation. And I was saying, wow, if he's coming out here now with home sales near record lows and they're already complaining about it, they have no interest in really talking about housing. In fact, when they thought housing was recovering, when purchase application data was going down in the last, it got back to 1995 levels when they were saying it's recovering. No Doubt was the top band back then. Gangster Paradise was the number one song. Stop Chasing Waterfall. I mean, they have taken a step backwards and are frantic about the housing market recovering. And I think part of it is that, the housing bubble years, they missed that. That was a credit market. And I think what Jerome Powell did wrong is that he said the housing market is a bubble, which means that home prices have to crash and inventory has to skyrocket. That is rookie ball. It isn't a bubble. We literally just had inventory break to all-time lows. And there's nothing the Fed really can do. So what happened? Rates went up, not to like 3%, 4%, 5%, went to 7% to 8%, and people aren't listing their homes. So they, on their own words, said, we never understood or we never thought that when rates went up, people won't list their homes. This shows a lack of experience internally by Fed presidents, because anybody would know that the credit markets don't allow you to list your home, sell and buy another one if you're not qualified. So when the housing total cost gets up so high, naturally, inventory won't grow as much as they want. So I always say it's a COVID-19 policy they have. They're afraid of everybody just living their lives right now. It's not, car sales are fine. Car sales are rising. New home sales are growing year over year. Retail sales just beat estimates. Employment is there, but the existing home sales market is still stuck at great financial recession lows, and they're not saying anything positive. That is an inherent president internal discussion to not be very pro-housing at this point. And this with the growth rate of inflation already falling more than they anticipated. So that's why I always say that I don't believe the Fed has pivoted. I believe they're very anti-housing at this point. They're not even trying to whisper to get the mortgage-backed security market better, because I feel they feel uncomfortable about talking about housing. This is why I would love to have all the Fed presidents in a roundtable discussion and to kind of tell them how things are working in a post-2010 world. And you don't have to be afraid of living, right? This is part of our society, right? People rent, they date, they mate, they get married 3.5 years after marriage, they have kids. People buy homes, they buy single family homes. This is how we've done it for decades. And rates getting back down to 6%, you don't have to come on TV and say, no, this is bad, you're making our jobs harder. So if it's too hard, go fishing. Go read history books. Right. Don't do this anymore, right? Gladly, we'll come and take over the job.
But staying on that though, so if there's so many of these factors that are, let's say, out of our control, but you know, being in the real estate and housing industry and in the lending industry, is it one of those situations that regardless of what's working against us, that the housing market is still going to move forward? Because like you said, people have to have shelter, so they have to have a place to live. So
yes, I think this was the one thing that I saw a lot of people not understand about the housing market. When home sales were crashing in 2022, people just naturally assumed it was going to keep on continuing in 2023. So we went from 6.5 million to 4 million, and people thought, well, we're going 4 down to 2 million. That 2 million is the level that we had in the early 1980s. After 1996, it's been very hard for the housing market to get sales below 4 million. And think about it. We got over 157 million people working. Everyone is not struggling to pay their pizza payment or whatever. We have a lot of dual household incomes. People make money. People sell their homes. They have a lot of nested equity. We still have cash buyers. So we're here, and this is the progress of our society is household formation. People buy homes, start their lives, kids go to school. So we've never really been able to break under kind of 4 million and just head much lower. But again, mortgage rates are simply too high to get real growth growing. And to me, real growth is when existing home sales trend between like 4.72 million and 5.31. That's basically the range of sales, that kind of the 5 million level that we've been accustomed to for the last few decades. But here it's just different, and they're not really commenting on it. And the fact that they're kind of not speaks loud. Now, I would say this, when mortgage rates got to 8%, the Fed presidents were like, oh, what's wrong? Why the 10-year yield? We don't know why it's going up, because you went hawkish at a wrong time. So I think they're starting to get with the program. But again, to me right now, as I speak, they are still very restrictive, especially to the housing market. Growth rate of inflation is falling. The job openings data is falling. The quits ratios are back to pre-COVID levels. And they're not saying anything conducive to get the housing market to grow, except kind of ignore the question. So myself and a few others were trying to get them to like own up to it. If they frankly come out and say, listen, we hate the housing market, we don't want home prices to go, or we don't want, fine, at least let everybody know. But staying quiet and giving these kind of Mickey Mouse answers here or there is not acceptable. But if they don't want to deal with it, there's a lot of Gen Xers that want to take the baby boomer spot and tell them to just go away, and we're going to create a new kind of economic model for a new society, and we're not going to be stuck to the 1970s anymore.
So what you're saying is they have not accepted your invite to come on your podcast?
No, and I would tell you, a few of the Fed governors and their staffers listen to my stuff, so I purposely try to give them clues on this, on things they, and one of the things they made a mistake is that they were saying the housing market was recovering when purchase application data was falling. And I screamed this out loud. Staffers, you get that out of the president's speeches. You don't let your boss go on TV at an event and say the housing market is recovering when we are basically down to 1995 right. Levels of purchase application. It's just a bad look. You got to, and like for us in our work, we are very up to date. We track stuff daily. We believe in weekly data. We don't have the luxury of being old and slow. So we try to keep people as informed as possible. And I see an institution being very slow. And at this time and age, like I've always said, 500-600 years ago, you could dispatch horses, go get information from another country. And then 6 months later, they'll come to you and they're going to tell you, hey, you're about to get invaded. Okay, now we have the internet. Things are fast, quick, everything. We want people reading information, and they just seem a little bit too slow for my taste.
Well, Sarah, you invited me on, and I'm hogging all the time, so go ahead.
You're okay. No, I'm glad that you mentioned boomers in your last answer, because we had a question about boomers come in, and that's just a good little segue. Someone had asked, how do you foresee inventory changing when boomers start selling and moving? Will that have a meaningful impact to inventory levels?
This is the silver tsunami premise, something very, very near and dear to my heart. So I need to explain this going back to the year 2008. The silver tsunami was a premise that all the baby boomers, they're massive. They own all these homes. They're going to start to sell their homes at a certain period of time, and inventory is going to really skyrocket, and home prices have to fall because millennials can't buy their McMansions, right? And it's a bit of marketing gimmick that has legs. I mean, it was supposed to be 2015 to 2025, right? Because the first baby boomer was 62 in 2008. By the time they're 69, that first wave of, this is the time where you start downsizing. It never happened. It's a ghost, right? And I say this, that even this year, we had some fake housing analysts come on CNBC and say, oh, the silver tsunami is coming this year. New listings data is trending at the lowest levels ever recorded in history. A tsunami was back in 2008 to 2011. We have this new listings data every single week. The peak in the last 3 years were between 70 to 90,000 in the heat months in the spring. A tsunami was 2008 to 2011, when that new listings data was running at 250 to 400,000 per week, right? So the boomers aren't moving. They're sitting in their homes, and they looks like they're going to sit there until they're dead. And that's what the data has shown. But every single year, you're going to hear a silver tsunami. We did it again this year. So what I see about that is that eventually, no country has a Dorian Gray labor market, and none of us live forever, and we don't take our homes with our graves. They will pass on toward the end of this decade. Nature wins. They will die. They'll give their homes to their children. Then we get to see what happens then. But as of right now, we are barely showing year-over-year growth on new listings data, which is trending at the lowest levels ever. So we don't see anything of that happening in the data. We never saw that in the data the last few years. But the baby boomers were the biggest home buyers last year, right? The millennials were the biggest home buyers for years, but they financed 90% plus of their mortgages. When rates went up too much, the baby, well, actually, technically Gen X was the biggest buyers, but nobody cares about us. So the baby boomers came there and bought more homes. And guess what? Inventory levels still stayed near record lows. So death to me is a very, very key economic factor. And toward the end of this decade, we'll get more supply naturally because people will die and give their homes off to their children. What their children do with it, who knows? They might live in it. They might rent it out. They might sell it. But we're not there yet. Our new listings data will capture any abnormalities. And so far, we haven't seen anything yet. We haven't seen anything yet, really, for over 10 years that would warrant a lot of these baby boomers selling in mass kind of conversations. But I understand why people got tricked here, because if the first baby boomer hit 62 in 2008 and 2015 to 2025 was supposed to be the big time, we're talking about 60 million homes, active listings getting to 26 to 32 million. We had 240,000 single family homes in March of 2022. We have a little bit above 500,000 today, a little bit above 500,000 single family homes available for sale for a country of 335 million and over 157 million workers. So not there yet, but I do believe in time, just because those boomers can't take their homes to the graves with them, their homes will give on to their children, what their children do. We will see. We're not there yet.
I feel like this is the conversation I have with my parents on a daily basis. But so I'm not sure if that's news that has a positive outlook for the long run, but it ties into our next question. So one of the things I think a lot, and I really did enjoy the economic forecast that you did with us. So again, we appreciate you coming on, and we hope to have you on, you know, for several years to come. But one of the things I think a lot of times is we're so focused in our industry on right now, what's affecting us today, this week, this month, this year. And when you look at, you know, your kind of, you know, outlook on things, what do you see in the next 3 to 5 years? You know, what's the thing that we need to get ahead of, or that we should be preparing for when you take in all of the things that you look at on a daily basis, all the conversations? What would that, you know, what would that be?
So right now we have two realistic variable factors for the next 3 to 5 years. Number one, Gen Z is massive. and they're coming, right? So in the industry, has to cater to a new type of generational buyer or refinance person, right? Which means that the old ways of doing more, like I remember as a loan officer, we had transboxes back in the days and we had like fax machines and we used to put our loans into paper and, you know, it took forever. Use the productivity that you have now because everyone's so lucky how people do mortgages now. It's so much faster and more efficient. Use your productivity and tend to cater to the Gen Z people that are coming because, you know, the baby boomers, if they do downsize, you know, especially after the age of 58, a lot of them buy their homes with cash, but you got a new buyer coming in and they might look at housing or the buying process a little bit differently than what we are accustomed to. So find the ways to connect to your customers. And also, especially for refinance, because once you get someone in, you don't want to make sure that you don't lose that person, right? Because in this industry, think about it. We have a lot more competition with a lot more technology and things are a lot faster now. So always establish your relationship with your clients early, but also realize that how you did loans with your friend's dad is going to be a little bit different how this generation is going to come into the next 3 to 5 years. Because the millennials, the oldest ones are over 40 now. So they're kind of passing through, but the next group is going to be here, and technology and AI and all these things are going to be something that's going to be with us for the next 3 or 5 years. Adapt yourself to become a more prolific and efficient loan officer to a new age where things move like this.
Fantastic.
I love that. That's awesome. So, Logan, we always end our episodes with a question. And first off, every time I hear you talk, I learn something new about things I never thought I'd be able to like understand and comprehend. So thank you for that. You lend forward a lot of knowledge.
Everyone needs a good nerdy friend, I say. You got to have one good nerdy friend in your life. So I
can check that box now. Check it.
Yeah.
Yes. I love that. So like I said, a lot of what you do, you know, you just lend forward a lot of information to everyone, but we always ask people, how do you plan to continue lending it forward in 2024 and beyond? So anything new on the horizon? Like what are your plans?
I'm going to tour as many states as I possibly can this year. So I'm trying to get the information out to people and trying to get people as much as the country into reading real data and what goes on. Because, you know, I see a lot of people give a forecast and then you don't hear from them. It's like they're gone. And then like 2-3 months later, they might come on and, hey, guess what? I don't believe in that. I literally barely sleep. I'm literally on the internet all the time. I'm tracking data. I'm trying to give people as much real-time information as I can. And because the NERD Tour was so successful last year, we're trying to hit up as many cities and states as possible. Because as all of you see, I do things a little bit different. I'm trying to get people energized and reading and following it. Because the more you know, right, the better you can be toward your clients. Also, if the other person doesn't know, boy, you're really showing a reflection that you're going to be the person to kind of explain a lot of things, because I can't be there all the time for everybody, but I could give you guys a pathway. So my thing going forward is to hit as many cities as possible as I physically can and do a lot of webinars to teach people that economics, I know if it's boring, it's not very exciting, but you don't it doesn't have to be. But when you feel more comfortable talking about economics, especially to your clients or what's going on, it gives that person a little bit more feeling a little bit more solid about the choice of working with you. Or you could be the person that doesn't know anything and just like, you know, just give me your business and just go ahead. This way, my job is to inform as many people as possible, because I always believe reading is a good thing. The history of human civilization has taught us that those that read will always have an advantage over those who don't. And I look at the reading stats for decades. Reading has gone down. So I'm trying to make reading fun and sexy again so everybody gets more knowledge of themselves.
That's awesome. Well, good luck on that. I agree that we should definitely all be pushing that message for sure. So just as Bill, did you have any other questions?
No, Sarah, I was just going to say, make sure you get Logan a list of the states that we're in. So if you come to town by any of our local offices, feel free to stop in. You can use one of our offices as a drop-in spot or just say hi.
Absolutely. The Nerd Tour is fun. The live presentations are great.
The Nerd Tour. I love it. All right, guys. Well, the link for the full economic forecast, if I didn't say this before, is going to be in the episode description. So be sure you check that out. Be sure you listen to everything Logan had to say on our episode today. Like I said, I'm always learning something new every time I hear him talk. But thank you again, Logan. Thank you, Bill, for co-hosting with me. And we will catch you guys on the next episode of Lending Forward.
Thanks for having me. Continue, Logan.
My pleasure. A lot of fun here.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube, and LinkedIn. Tune in next week for another new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSconsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia, 23452.